Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as we finally get into the conversation that I had with Rak Razam that got transcribed and edited and put into the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT Anthology book. And I've been sitting on this for a while, and I'm happy to bring it to you today. But of course, just a few quick announcements before we get into the conversation that Rak and I had several months ago now. So first, just want to start off with issuing some thanks. Thanks to Brooke and James, two names you've heard many times before here on the podcast because they make a small monthly contribution via PayPal. Every month comes in thanks to them. So they've been doing it for a long time, which means they are major supporters of this podcast. So thank you very much, Brooke and James. Your monthly support is always deeply appreciated. And also thanks and congratulations to Snope, who has signed up at the God Molecule level over at my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/martinwball. And at $100 a month, Snope gets a complimentary 1-hour consultation, which is a little bit of a discount off of my regular consultation fees for 1 hour. And also, he just got his very first thank you gift, which is a t-shirt with my art on it, because he has been there for 3 months now. And every 3 months at that level, you get both a sticker with my art and a t-shirt with my art on it. Of course, if you'd like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Stop by my personal webpage, www.martinball.net. Use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can link to Patreon from right there, and you can sign up for $1 a month all the way up to $100 a month with increasing access, benefits, and gifts as you go along through those various tiers. And just want to issue another general thank you to everybody who supports me over at Patreon. It's not a large group of people. It makes a huge difference in my monthly income. I mean, it really does make a big difference. I really do appreciate it. It's ongoing support, and you know, people come and go over there as things change for them. But for those who have been there and continue to be there, who have ever been there, thank you very much for your support over at Patreon. I really deeply appreciate it. As a completely independent, self-employed person, that it's your support that helps make all of this possible. Coming up on the podcast, just want to let you know of what interviews we have in the works. I do have an interview that was recorded a couple months ago with James Lanthier from Mindset Pharma. That's going to be the next interview that I release here on the podcast after the next selection from the audiobook to Entheological Paradigm. Then coming up in the next week, I've got another interview with Kat Courtney, who's coming from Plant Medicine People. I've got Ray Christian from Soiree and also the Psychedelic Diaries podcast. And then the week after that, we've got Victoria Wushner from Kaivalya Collective and Tandava Retreats, and also one of the contributors to the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT book. And I've got more interviews in the works. So there's lots of interviews. Going to be lots of new interviews here on the podcast in between selections of the Entheological Paradigm. So lots to look forward to here. Now, regarding my conversation with Rak, just to let you know, we were not using my standard recording setup, which is Skype, which allows me to separate the audio tracks between myself and the person that I'm interviewing. And so here, Rak and I were using, I think we were using Zoom, and then he was having it transcribed automatically by YouTube, and I don't know. Anyway, the way that it works out is my volume level is way less than his, and also there's some audio bounce back, and there really isn't anything that I can do about that other than to try and compress the entire audio. So my part of the conversation is a little bit garbled and has some audio echo to it, and it's pretty soft, but Rak's side comes through very, very well, of course. And, you know, if you need any clarification, go out and get yourself a copy of Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, an anthology of approaches to working with the God molecule, as Rak's contribution is transcribed and written in that book there. Da-dum. Okay, that's all the announcements that I have for today. I hope that you're enjoying your summer or your winter, wherever you may be in the world. Of course, I am Always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your psychedelic and entheogenic experience, specializing in 5-MeO-DMT, but of course not limited to that particular molecule. You can stop by at www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you would like more details, or just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com. All right, and of course, I'll put some more new music of mine after our conversation, and of course, you can always find my music at Apple Music, Amazon, Spotify, you know, wherever you find online music, and also martinball.bandcamp.com. That's actually the best place to go to get my music, because I've got stuff to download for free. You can stream it all online. You can download it. It's great, and you can choose what kind of file you want as well. So, hope you enjoy the conversation. Hope you enjoy the music that comes after that. And next week, we'll have another selection from the entheological paradigm. Here we go with Brack Razam. Who do you serve?
But what I wanted to do that might be a valuable and unique take on the thing is basically discuss what I believe is happening with facilitators who work with the medicine. And, you know, there's been so much discourse over the last 5 years around, you know, best practices and the mechanics. And I'll touch upon that a bit, but really it's more of a top-end perspective on the art of being in service. I call it, who do you serve, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, we'll get to this, but I believe that it's bigger than you think. It's not just the clients, right? There's a lot, it's the larger process that's underway. So maybe I'd preface by saying that, you know, I was introduced to this medicine of 5-MeO-DMT in the jungles of Peru in a very unorthodox set and setting with the, you know, the EEG helmet, Dr. Juan Acosta, Ron Wheelock, who had the synthetic version. And, you know, it completely changed my life, and it set me on that course of documenting both ayahuasca, but secretly 5-MeO-DMT. I remember that first experience, like 3 weeks into my ayahuasca journey of 3 months, which was going to become the book and the film, My Awakenings, and really tossing the dice and thinking I could throw it all away and just do 5-MeO-DMT forever. Mm. And, you know, essentially what happened is I had to integrate that. It was a 7-year journey to make all the media about it. And then boom, 5-MeO entered my life again with Octavio Redig. And I hadn't done 5-MeO between 2006 and 2015. Except when I had some NMDMT experiences that went to the 5-MeO frequency in retrospect. And in retrospect, mm-hmm. looking back on my life, the first time I did NMDMT was a 5-MeO-DMT experience, classically. So anyway, basically after being reinitiated with the toad, Bufo ovarius toad medicine under the auspices of the infamous Octavio Redig, it set me on that path of being in service. And so I am pretty high profile as a personality within our very small subculture of psychedelic medicine. And I really felt that I never had any intentions to be a facilitator of the medicine, when in fact what I stepped into from the moment I came back from that first toad experience at Easter 2015 was to be deeply in service to the community, to be basically a herald and to be a facilitator of the community to explain 5-MeO-DMT and to make sense of it and to create containers for it so that the cultural engagement could happen in a way. Because as we know, this medicine, while it does have some iconography with the toads in Mexico, does not have an unbroken lineage in the Mexican tradition. And also, even in the Western tradition, synthetic 5-MeO does go back, you know, to the 70s, 80s, even maybe a bit before, but it doesn't have the structure. So basically, I still have a one-page document, which is like, you know, scrawled on the back of a napkin, which is outlining all these potentials culturally of how 5-MeO-DMT came into the culture. And within that, there's like guilds of practitioners. There was like what became WEBAC. There was all these ideas of where the molecule carried me. And, you know, Mario Garnier, the other lead director of the World Bufo Ovarius Congress, and I, he likes to say that, you know, the molecule has its own agenda, whether it's synthetic or toad. And it's not the molecule, obviously, it's the spirit in the molecule or behind the molecule or the force that is revealed in the fullness of the 5-MeO-DMT experience, which I believe is the act of intelligence of source consciousness shaping its creation. And this is crucial because for me, having felt and seen an ultimate intelligence and an understanding of the way that is working through us, through this culture, it directly affects my perception of facilitators and the role they play in the rollout of this molecule getting into the world and being integrated into culture. So that leads me to say, let me think.
Can I ask you a couple just follow-up questions on that? One is sort of your experience from having experienced 5-MeO and sort of this urge to be of service is something that's very common with people with 5-MeO, either helping to promote education around it or also help to facilitate in various ways, or as you say, bring community together. And it seems to be a very common reaction to 5-MeO. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, I know for you it was very personal in that sense, but do you have any thoughts on sort of the broader implications of that?
Absolutely. And this is very fundamentally coming down to the who do you serve integration and understanding. So, you know, my shorthand for this is, you know, if 100 people do ayahuasca, maybe 3 will think that they want to serve the medicine, maybe 1, maybe none, because it's challenging, it's purgative, it has all these things. With 5-MeO-DMT, I mean, you know, it seems like 1 in 5 people want to serve them in medicine. But really what I always reorient people towards is this desire to be in service doesn't mean you have to be a facilitator. In fact, in some ways you could say we're all facilitating the integration of this medicine back into the culture, into the species. And so essentially, if you take a top-down approach or a holistic approach, and you're not looking at it from the human ego of here I am as a facilitator doing a 9-to-5 job, but if you realize the molecule and the intelligence behind the molecule is actually permeating through the species, right? And, you know, what we have learned is that 5-MeO-DMT is a replicable technology of the sacred, and it is endogenous to all mammals, including human beings. And so we already have the on switch. We have the ability to have this connection without synthetic or the toad, but we've needed the training wheels to remember that we are the medicine. And so, you know, when you have a unity experience, like a full release 5-MeO-DMT contact experience, many, many things happen, right? So essentially there can be, the shorthand is, it's like the mind is lowering. The neuroscience has proven, as well as the traditional psychedelics that affect the default mode network and the 5-HT2A receptors, things like that, which 5-MeO is probably doing as well. My neuroscience, through working with Dr. Michael Villanueva and Dr. Juan Acosta and others, has shown that it's working on the parietal and frontal lobes of the brain, and it's reducing the electrical activity of those frontal lobe regions where that egoic sense of identity resides. So the pattern matching with EEG and MRI scans on monks has been identical, that it's the same experience as what the pathway development of many years meditating or breath work or mantras or anything that's actually modulating your egoic consciousness and calming it down to lower that filter, that gate between you and source consciousness within. So as that lowers, we know that there can be healing effects. There can be a release of trapped energy in the energetic body, in the emotional body, in all the fine gradation of being that we are. And that is what the majority of the Western psychedelic renaissance is focusing on. They're focusing on 5-MeO-DMT as a replacement for the SSRIs, as an antidepressant, as things which can heal mental imbalances and traumas, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the very thin edge of the wedge. And it's, for me, it feels like those are peripheral effects as you cleanse and open to the fullness of your divine being. And so, you know, as this contact experience with source is engaged with and cleared in the physical organism, there can be, I mean, it's tricky because the more deeper in you go, the mind traditionally also lets go. So there's a sweet spot in there, which I call the event horizon of deep source, where there's just a witnessing consciousness, which in Sanskrit they have language for, and they have understanding of the different levels of the samadhi or the fullness of that sort of source contact experience. But essentially, there is an ability to remember, to remember, you know, my shorthand again is that, you, as the poet Rumi says, you are not the drop, you are the ocean in the drop. But as the cohesion of that individuality, which is also separation from the totality, starts to occur, there can be a witnessing consciousness, which is not the intellectual egoic consciousness. It's just a witnessing being, a presence, which is in some ways indistinguishable from source itself. It's like that oceanic consciousness. So this contact experience is like a species inoculation. It's like a divine homeopathic shot of awe that can help us to remember our divine nature and who and what we really are. This is fundamental to understanding what we are doing as facilitators. So I feel that the people, whether you call them clients or participants or whatever language you have for the people that you may serve as a facilitator, many of them, and not everyone, everyone has a different type of wetware and a different type of bio, you know, makeup, a different capacity and a different language to describe the experience that they're having. But the vast majority of people usually, you know, would agree that they're having a contact experience with a larger entity or presence or space. And I like to reorient people back again and remember that it's not external to you, it's internal to you. So it is so transformative. And, you know, if you look at the history books, this is the history of religion, and not necessarily the dogmatic Abrahamic religions with all their dogma and karma and all of that, but the religious impulse, which, you know, the Latin for religion means to reweave or to reconnect. And what are we reconnecting to but the divine source, our true nature? So, of course, people that have this experience and do experience the fullness and do have the capacity to remember it, it slips off the conscious mind like a dream in many ways. But in the knowing, it basically, I feel, reformats the whole being. And it reformats us, lets go of all the energies we've been carrying. And, you know, I've got a translation of a 1913 commentary on the Upanishads, and they spend a lot of time talking about the logos in this translation, which is a Greek word. But this idea of, you know, it's basically a sub-program of God. It's like the active intelligence of God in the creation, the word of God, the logos. But essentially, they talk about this and the relationship we as extensions of source consciousness can have with source. All of our culture in the West and in the global culture now, I believe, has species PTSD. I believe that it basically is separated from nature, and it's been 12,000, almost 13,000 years of this march of history, which is really a tapestry of our trauma. And we are living within a culture which is basically a simulation. We're living in a simulation of what reality really is. Can look outside your window and see nature, but then we go back to our screen. It's like we're not connecting to it. So, you know, by letting go of this trauma and opening up this divine presence, we're reinitializing our connection with ourselves, with our deeper selves. And so this translation of the Upanishads talks essentially about this seed of God that we all have within us. You could call it Buddha nature, you could call it whatever, but there's this flickering or this potential. And this potential is activated over many lifetimes until there is a potential to essentially anchor God in the human form, right? To bridge heaven, okay? And this is what a lot of the Indian mystic Eastern meditation traditions point towards, that the whole process that they engage with meditation, breathwork, and their modalities is to clean out the organism, to clean the yamas and the niyamas, all the things that we energetically hold on to, all the samskaras, all the filtering layers that we create that obfuscate and separate us from the divine nature within. And so, you know, many of their gurus and holy people have achieved this bridging state. They call them Juvan Muktas, the idea that you can be God on earth and conscious and have an ego, right? Like no one's trying to destroy the ego, but we're trying to tame the ego. We're trying to remind the ego that it is in service to God, right? And that it is an extension of God. It's a sub-program, just like the Logos is a sub-program. Anyway, so all of this is just a little bit of mimetic architecture to describe the process that I believe is involved. And that essentially when we have a full release on 5-MeO-DMT, or through an endogenous experience, a mystical experience that happens endogenously, it initiates this process of that seed germinating and growing in relationship. So when we come to this experience that people have, and then they're like, oh my God, like, you know, maybe they don't have words for it, but they have felt it in a deeper level of their being that is beyond words, and they know. And so basically they're a convert, right? We're all converts. We shy away from this religious meme and stream in our culture because of the bad rap of religion. But again, just let go all those religions that have come before and remember, religion is an active verb of connecting to your divine nature. And we are all getting it. The 5-MeO culture globally is religified. You know, that's even a word. I mean, but we don't have a structure. It's forming, and it's forming itself through us. And so essentially, you know, people who have the 5-MeO experience will want to share the experience. Oh my God, my mom has to do that. My dad has to do that. My parents have to do it. My friends and family have to do it. But it's the ego filter that has come back and is like making sense of its own experience. But there's this quality of wanting to share it, because that is the unity field. This feeling that we've remembered and reclaimed the frequency of unity, but then we come back to duality. How do we get back to unity? And so we're instinctively sort of migrating towards this idea of switching on the others. You know, Tim Leary had this great quote in the 60s where there were many great little sound bites, but as well as the turn on, tune in, drop out, there was find the others. And, you know, I forget who it is. It might be Ram Dass or Krishnamurti or one of the Eastern guys. He says, there are no others. And in the unity field, this is exactly it, right? So you've got to understand all of space-time, past, present, future, has already happened and happening all at once. It's a 12-dimensional plus organism that is like an artifact. And outside of that space-time artifact is source consciousness. It's multidimensional. You could chuck in whatever quantum hoo-ha you want, but science starts to come around to this idea of the implicate of this pure source, which basically projects part of itself or a hologrammatic sort of extension of itself to create the material universe. So the thing is, that implicate source consciousness is not separate from its creation. And its creation is modulating itself over space-time with instruction from source consciousness. There's a purpose to it. So 5-MeO-DMT, I feel, is similar but different from all the other psychedelics in that it is endogenous, so is N,N-DMT, but the tryptamines in general. The thing about the tryptamines and 5-MeO, it seems to overwrite the other psychedelics, that once you've had this galactivation, this activation of that seed of God within you, anytime you perturb or alter your default mode network, it can just sort of 5-MeO frequency can bleed through and just come into the other experiences. It wants to come into our vessels. So this is all to say that the people who want to be facilitators, it's the ego filter thinking small, right? It's thinking small. It's like, all right, there's a religious impulse to share this experience. But the thing you've got to remember is this experience is dormant, and it's still in everyone right now. Everyone is God on earth, but they haven't switched. They haven't opened. Even some people that have the experience may have a peak experience, may think it's a drug experience, might not have the vocabulary or the, let's say, energetic complexity to understand and hold the immensity of it, but they're still getting switched on. So, you know, I like to think on really large species level and talk on that mythopoetic level. And it seems to me that there's a species activation happening. And again, these external catalysts through toad and synthetic are external catalysts to remember our internal capacity. But essentially, when people want to share, often they like, okay, well, you just light a pipe, right? What is there to it? They're not thinking. They're thinking, all right, they're not thinking about the mechanics and the role in the world and the interface with the client facilitator relationship. They're just awash with this awe, right? With this desire to connect and this desire to share. And behind that, what I really believe is happening is a species activation, which is coming through in everyone and spreading this activation of 5-MeO-DMT. So number one, I'll just say that there are many ways to serve. And okay, what usually...
Hold on. So you're on a roll. I love it. I really want to ask a meta question though. Mm. So you and I, we both are really coming from the same place about what the 5-MeO-DMT experience is. We use slightly different language, but we're very much in agreement that this is divine source, God consciousness coming into human form and becoming aware of itself. And so kind of a meta question is, as 5-MeO is being looked at in more of a therapeutic context, right? That there's different companies that are looking to develop 5-MeO DMT products and saying, hey, let's give people a mystical experience and that will help them overcome their trauma, and we'll do it very quickly in a nice therapeutic setting. The question is there room, in your opinion, to be agnostic about this sort of this insistence that you and I and many other people in the field are saying, look, this is divine source consciousness. This is God. This is what we're really talking about. And we're not really leaving a lot of wiggle room for, say, agnosticism about it, where, oh, well, it's just a drug or who knows. Yeah. I was wondering if you have any commentary on that before we get into the specifics that you want to share about facilitation itself.
Yes, I think there's room for everything, in the sense that, again, everything we're experiencing in our culture is through the filter of our ego and our cultural and species ego. And so the Western medical, you know, industrial establishment, you know, it's sick. It's not necessarily healthy. It's the pharmaceutical, big pharma is in control of it. And so essentially after a generation of SSRIs and antidepressants, not working, psychedelics are coming in, there's a bleed through switchover happening. The issue is, yes, I mean, you may have seen the news where they're trying to sort of, you know, deconstruct the psychedelic component of psychedelics and still have, you know, some sort of biochemical shift in the being. But, you know, the Johns Hopkins study from, I think, 2006, 2007 on the mystical experience clearly showed that it was basically this ego reduction dash dissolving dash, you know, letting go, the full release letting go on whatever psychedelic you're on, that is the mystical experience essentially, because it's reducing our separation of the egoic filter, which allows for that physical, emotional, energetic healing that they want from these as drugs in the psychedelic Renaissance paradigm. So on that level, yes, I think that basically they're thinking they can compartmentalize these substances and make them products. And to a degree they can, but they have no real idea of the ramifications of the person taking these products having an intimate sacred experience beyond their paradigm to understand. So I just have faith that, again, everything is orchestrated by a greater power, and our ego just grabs at the little, it nibbles at the edges and tries to compartmentalize stuff that's going to be a product that can be sellable and work within capitalism. It's freaking crazy, because this thing is beyond all isms. And so just trust the process in regards to that. You know, let's put it out there and show them that there's more. But I think there's a transformation of the medical establishment happening if they use these substances, especially 5-MeO-DMT.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So in general, I just wanted to finish off that thing about, you know, people wanting to serve. And so essentially that impulse and that connection we described behind that impulse, there are many ways to serve. So, you know, an individual facilitator or person who first has it, somewhere along the line, someone says, oh my God, I want to share this medicine. I want to serve this medicine. And maybe they approach it from a more pragmatic, egotistical, like this is a business. Or maybe they have this sort of religious fervor. And of course, there can be all that sort of messianic aggrandizement you've got to sort through. There's stages and processes of a 5-MeO facilitator's understanding of what they're in and what they're going through. But essentially, when you have that full release, I believe that, you know, you have been activated in your being. And it's like our bodies are temples to host the divine essence. And there is an initialization, what I call our heart drive, not our hard drive, but it's a similar process in a metaphor, right? It's like something is activated within us and we go, all right, oh my God, this is the biggest thing on earth. I want to share this with people. But it doesn't mean you have to be the person lighting the pipe and taking the great and grave responsibility of looking after people's health and well-being and being the rock that holds that space. You might not have the skills for that. You might not have the ability to do that. And, you know, there are many ways to serve. So essentially what metastatizes is a community. Eventually, a facilitator will develop a network. They will develop a network of people in their own community. And within that, in physically hosting, you know, people, if you just work with one-on-ones, it might be a therapeutic model. You still need a space to do it in. You might need a host. If you do groups, you definitely need a space to do it in, inside or outside. You need a host. You might do retreats. You may need a cook. You may need, you know, help with marketing or the underground connecting to the network. You may need to reach out to medical teams and get expertise and feedback. this is not a lone wolf activity, right? This is part of a community engagement with a sacred technology. And what I'm saying is the act of intelligence in the medicine is guiding all of us, I believe. And when we connect and when it promulgates through our communities, it self-organizes to create a container for itself. And so I say to people, be really careful, really feel into why you feel you want to serve. You've had this unity experience, we all have, and there are many ways to serve. And in fact, you know, one facilitator needs the support of a team to be in greater service to his community. So you can support people who are doing the facilitation. That is really needed as well. Or the, you know, you can bring people in, or you can buddy with them and shepherd them and be the sitter or the integration support. And that's a whole nother much needed and necessary, you know, thing to do. So there are many ways to serve the awakening process that 5-MeO-DMT engenders. That's one thing to tie that off. Eventually, so essentially what I'd like to say is what I really believe is that we are vessels. And as a facilitator who has experienced this medicine, it's really about the capacity you have to serve when choosing to serve in your being and in your vessel. And remembering that I do believe that there is a entrainment by source itself. And, you know, what we see in the community, there's, well, let's be frank, there's good facilitators and there's bad facilitators, regardless of their intentions to give a service to the community. On a fundamental level, there are things which can go wrong, and there are checks and balances and things which must be maintained in a safe and sacred and sound container to do the work. And so this idea of the vessel, what I say to people, and just I should have said this at the start, you know, since I started being in service to the medicine in 2015, I did evolve into a point of being a facilitator myself and, you know, working in countries where this is legal, essentially mm-hmm. Mexico. And, you know, I got to this point of helping organize events, helping organize conferences, helping organize everything on a community level, doing everything but light the pipe, because I felt like I was too profile, high public, and didn't want that responsibility until it got to this day. And I remember this feeling of growing resentment of doing 9/10 of the work and not the final little leg, and realizing, oh shit, it's time to serve. Like, mm-hmm. And that was after a full year as a full-time job of being in service to the medicine and other facilitators on retreats and et cetera, organizing everything, driving the bus, being the water boy, leading clients up and back from the launch space, you know, like doing everything. And basically it was an apprenticeship. It was an apprenticeship I didn't realize was happening because I was so enthused. I took my enthusiasm from my first experiences and poured it into service to support others who were facilitating, until it got to the point where I'd done that and it came to this fruition point where I really deeply felt, oh, it's time to serve in countries where this is legal.
Yeah. And so at that point, are you then developing your own style of facilitation, or are you using that apprenticeship time period? In other words, what combination of elements did you decide, yes, I like this, or maybe no, I don't like that, or I want to do it this way?
These are very good questions. And so I recommend to anyone who is feeling of stepping into service, A, you need more experience. Your experience, even though it can be very similar for everyone, it's about the lens of their ego and their individualism of how they connect with that experience and, you know, what they're carrying, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially, you need more experience to see other people and how they react. And the best way to do that is to sit with many facilitators and see the different styles. So I am familiar with the Conclave.info, who is a guild of conscientious practitioners who work with 5-MeO-DMT. I ascribe to their ethics and best practices documents, which are freely available on their website. And within that, there is a larger best practices, like 12, 18 page document, which goes into a lot of detail of attempting to give context to all the different parameters and ways that I have, you know, we have all seen people serve. And so some people serve one-on-one. They might be in a therapeutic model. Some people work in a more shamanic model. Some people work outside. Some people work standing up, sitting down, inside. And, you know, essentially, you know, the basis is, and I said it before, a safe and sacred and sound container. That's the basis for the work. So, you know, I do believe that within, before people get to working with the medicine, you know, a client relationship, they need to be pre-screened. You need to be looking for medical conditions, psychological issues. You want to also establish in that process a rapport, you know, a connection with the person. This is something which is such an incredibly large initiation on a psychic and physical level. You don't just rock up to this and then rock out again, businessman's lunch, and go back to 9-to-5 work. This is something completely transformative. And you need trust in your facilitator. The client needs trust. And so, you know, you need to establish a rapport. So all of these subtleties really start to modulate the way you hold space and the container you hold space in. And you grow and you change in your ability and understanding of what is a safe container and the style that you will develop. So I was first given medicine by, you know, synthetic by Ron Wheelock in the jungles of Peru. It was just a provider lighting a pipe. I next received medicine from Dr. Octavio Redick, who has a very controversial engagement with our community. And to be frank, has killed people and has hurt people. And I believe, you know, for good or worse, believed in what he was doing. And I still, you know, he was still my first teacher. I learned as much of what to do as what not to do from Octavio that felt right for me. And I had seen other people that try to copy his style. And I am amazed because A, you have to be Octavio to copy his style, and B, there are lots of things I don't agree with in that style. I don't agree with the waterboarding. I don't agree with the electric shocks. I don't necessarily agree with standing up. I don't agree with rape blown up the nose while you're in the medicine. I don't agree with lack of empathic duty of care and watching over people, you know, that if you leave them alone, something could go wrong. All of those things. And I don't really want to get into all that. Okay, but what I'm saying is you learn from other facilitators. You learn from seeing things. And so I have sat with the church, the Temple of Awakening Divinity. I've sat with you. I've sat with Octavio. I've sat with quite a few Mexican practitioners who really, some of them, not all of them, but some of them have. We know that there's not an indigenous Mexican lineage which can be proven, but there is an indigenous Mexican practice of curanderismo, of shamanism, of medicine work. And that style blending with the new arrival or the re-arrival of 5-MeO has an energetic lineage. And so I've worked with a lot of them. And, you know, one of the concrete differences perhaps between a lot of the Western styles of facilitation and the more indigenous style is the potentially controversial issue of doing a little bit of medicine at the same time as a client. And I know you used to do that. I don't always, and it depends on the scale and the work of the people, but when starting out and still I still do, is that I like to connect with the medicine on smaller amounts. This reminds me of the practice of ayahuasca curanderismo, of their brand of shamanism, where you might, to compare, you know, the first times you do ayahuasca, you are flawed. It's overwhelming. Same with 5-MeO. But what I've learned is that, you know, I can do it with toad. About 20 to 25 milligrams is my sweet spot of to be functional in the space. Now, this is actually an inverse thing, that this is not what a client needs to do. No one needs to be egoically functioning and doing things on the medicine. But as a facilitator, you have a duty of care to hold that space, to keep that space sacred, and to be in service. So sometimes taking a small amount of medicine yourself would potentially not be a good thing to be, hold service for other people. But I do find it lowers the egoic function and it opens to the field. And in combination with that witnessing consciousness and functioning egoic witnessing consciousness and an empathic immediate presencing with the client, it just enables a flow. And again, this idea of being a vessel to get me out of the way so source can use my vessel to be in service with the client. Now, there's a big overstep that it can happen if you are projecting your projections onto a client. You know, basically, essentially, I believe at a fundamental level, we hold space. And I say to people, to clients I work with, I'm not a shaman. I am a facilitator, but I don't believe this is a traditional facilitation engagement. I basically say that what I believe my role is as a facilitator the closest archetype is not a shaman, it's a midwife or a doula, right? Mm. In that this is a natural process that people have within them already that is being revealed, and that we are facilitating that process like midwives of the divine, that we're not healing them, but we are in service to their awakening and to their healing and to their process that 5-MeO initiates in them. And so as part of that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I draw upon from therapy, this idea of like, got to be careful about our projection, their projection, about becoming a focal point for them. I try to stay out of their line of sight. And then yet if they do catch me, I will hold that gaze. But there can be a lot of therapeutic sort of issues that are probably well documented in the therapeutic community that are very active and relevant to serving 5-MeO DMT. Also, what I have felt is that this is not a clean therapeutic Western psychoanalytic container or process. This is a holy, sacred, mystical process. And there are so many variables that you really shouldn't and can't talk about in the public arena because they're out of context and will get misunderstood. Yeah. But essentially, if I'm doing a little bit of medicine with people, which I have learned from other Mexicans in their tradition, it's like, as I said, this ayahuasca thing, eventually you become functional in the space and yet you're not in your normal consciousness. You become a vessel for this bridging again of source consciousness to work through you. And the danger is that sounds egotistical. It's like, it's not you, it's source consciousness. I know, but internally in the process, this is what it is. This is what I believe is happening. And so, you know, the best thing is this intuitive capacity that has enabled me to respond to people's needs. And it doesn't mean that you can't do this without taking medicine necessarily, but I do find sometimes there is a flatness and a sort of a filter of disengagement from that process. So just to say that, you know, that engagement with smaller amounts of medicine working with the client and not with every round and not with every client, essentially, you know, if it's going to be of service, will this be of service to them? If someone is going into like Shavasana or an open thing and they're just lying there and it's like, as a midwife, it's like, look, this is a natural process of rebirthing. It's like if the baby gets stuck, then there will be an intervention. There may be some touch, getting consent for touch beforehand, explaining the general parameters of what that may mean. But generally, I say to them, this is your process and it's your sacred space. If there is energetic blockages, if people are like caught and there's like this thing, sometimes, you know, I use some rattles and feathers and other elements. There is an element of facilitating a ceremony which has a more shamanic approach of not necessarily like singing Icaros. I usually use recorded music in indoor work, but the mise-en-scene is in set and setting of creating a flavor, creating an energy in the space of if they're really screaming their head off, then the rattle has an energy to it which will peak and carry and seem to energetically complement the peak of that energy. Someone would say, well, maybe that energy doesn't need interfering with. What I'm attempting to do is to always complement and to assist in any shifts of energy that need to happen within them if they're stuck. If they're not stuck and they're just processing, then I'm holding space without getting in their face or interfering. But there's a delicate art of engagement which can only be learned through a lot of practice. And essentially be learned through larger exposure to different ways and different modalities from model practitioners.
Yeah. And something that you had mentioned earlier that is related to this, that is not just about observing various facilitators and their methodologies and their forms of intervention and interaction, but also having the opportunity to actually observe many different people have a 5-MeO DMT experience. Because as we all know, someone has an experience and they tend to think, oh, this is what it does, right? Whatever my experience was, that's what it does. But as soon as you start observing large collections of people, you realize that there are, to use your language, there are many different ways that this midwifing actually takes place in terms of an energetic process. And it's very unique to each individual. So getting that opportunity to observe large numbers of people, you get to see this wide range of reactions. And also that is where you can begin to develop the knowledge of where certain forms of intervention might actually be helpful. In the same way as if someone is giving birth, you know, if the baby's coming out and there's no problem, well, then you just encourage the woman to push and the baby comes out. But there are times where there's a breach, or you might need a cesarean, or you might need a blood transfusion. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a good metaphor, but it's only by having that breadth of knowledge of observation that we can even begin to understand why intervention or why interaction might be necessary at some times, and then other times where we can really trust that let's just allow this process to take place that's occurring here.
And that's why, you know, many people have these experiences like, oh my God, I want to be a facilitator. They think that everyone's going to have their experience, and it's a geography that exists within us. But to get to the core of it, you've got to go work through all your layers. And so everyone has trauma, and everyone has ego and filters, and everyone has stuff. And this is why, you know, I believe that, you know, fundamentally, you need to have a relationship with the client before you get into the ceremony. You need to know that their heart's in good condition, blood pressure's good, they're not on SSRIs. You need to know if they've got any trauma. You need like a questionnaire and a medical induction form. And that evens out a lot of problems that may arise, because, you know, if they've been sexually abused, you've known about it. And, you know, like if a woman has been sexually abused and I'm working with them, I will ask for them, or I will get a female facilitator to be present, so I can not be a triggering presence in that field. And you need to know these things because it cuts down on the things that can go wrong, right? But essentially, one person's experience is not going to be your experience, even though the destination is the same destination. And that is really important to understand. And as you said, you can only understand that by seeing a wide spectrum of people's presentations or responses to the medicine.
Yeah. All right. So then in terms of stepping into it yourself, how did that grow and develop for you?
Well, I mean, there's all these different levels to this. On a baseline cultural level, you know, we know that psychedelics are having a renaissance, and that all the major Western media is essentially positively pushing psychedelics. And so the supply and the demand of people wanting to experience this medicine is big. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues around the business of spirituality and ethically creating a container for the work. But essentially what I find is it becomes a path, and the path is walked one step at a time. And essentially, like I realized when I said yes to being a facilitator, I said yes to each step of the path. So it's like, yes, I will collaborate with another facilitator on a retreat in Mexico, and that will lead to fractal pathways. Although, yes, I will, you know, collaborate and do this, or, oh, yes, I will go to this meeting and meet other facilitators and learn from them. Or, you know, there was an enthusiasm in my first honeymoon phase with the medicine for a good 18 months of meeting so many other facilitators and people. And I've got to say, like back in 2015, 2016, it's the heyday of at least Toad 5-MeO, and things just keep changing. Things have rapidly kept, it is just exponentially growing. So, you know, a lot of that was working to develop WeBack and cultural containers on a larger level for the community to come together and integrate their experiences of 5-MeO-DMT. And then, of course, you know, just learning over time. And I'll say one thing, you know, I have been serving this medicine essentially 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, a good 5-6 years. And the honeymoon phase wears off, right? On some level, that blush of religious grandiosity fades. And if you're not careful, this can become a job, right? Yeah. It can become a 9-to-5. And I've always been conscious of the money in the medicine to try to separate them, in the sense of, I believe this is an integral and spiritual path and pursuit, and that there are larger forces at work in it. And that as part of that, that you deserve to be reciprocated and nurtured on a financial level, but you've got to set your own parameters on that cultural level. And then just let that go, right? It's not about that. Don't chase the money. Don't chase the next thing. Don't chase the fame and the fortune and the ego. Because, you know, as with all psychedelics, there can be ego dissolving, but the ego bounces back. And the ego is like, oh my God, I'm a shaman, right? And yeah, it's like, that's not why you should be doing this work. I mean, think about it. This midwife thing, it's a holy pursuit, but it's it's a very old, very, very old archetype and service in the human community, like us birthing ourselves, us rebirthing ourselves. And if we keep a spiritual perspective, it keeps us clean. So what I really see happening is this is hard work, and it is work. And after a while, when the honeymoon phase wears off, it can just become light that pipe and there's another client and put the money in the bank and then go home. You've got to keep fresh. You've got to keep clean. And I really seriously believe, I think I did a talk at one of your conferences a few years ago, and there was the flowering soul and there was the ocean and the drop. The flowering soul was examining this idea that after your first initiation with a peak experience psychedelic, the spiritual traditions of the world tell us the next step is purification, right? So as part of your integration, you don't just go back to normal, you're activated and you need to maintain that activation. So for a facilitator, what we see in as things crest into the mainstream, we see all the bad news, we see all the dirty laundry, and it's important that we work on this as a community, but essentially on a personal level, there can be power dynamics, money dynamics, issues with money and sexuality. All of these things are reflections of our shadow. And so our shadow as facilitators permeates the ceremony. It permeates the way we approach people. Say you're in a ceremony with a beautiful woman. Oh my God, then there's an energy there. And of course we know there are ethical protocols, how to engage with people, men or women or whatever. But what I'm saying is energetically, our energy sets the tone for a ceremony and the choices we make. And we need to be in control or aware of our shadows. And the purification process on a spiritual path is there for you as a spiritual soul, but it's equally important as a facilitator holding space for other people to be in a purification process yourself. And I believe that what happens when the dirty laundry hits the mainstream with psychedelics and 5-MeO facilitation, we're seeing the egos of certain facilitators who are just full of shadow or haven't done their own work, or are coming from a more baseline egoic starting point of, you know, that base chakra, money, power, sex, all that stuff, which is it's not to say that, you know, you might not have a great ceremony. We could look at the infamous case of the two Mexican doctors. Many people tried to defend them on different levels saying, well, I had a great ceremony. It's the medicine. The medicine is good medicine. It will give you a good experience if you clean stuff. But there are so many ways to improve that ceremony, to the container that is held and the personality of the person providing or serving that medicine. So essentially, the shadow of a facilitator is going to hit the fan eventually if you bring that energy and that into a ceremony, and that could go wrong. And so what I see in my experience is the medicine and the intelligence in the medicine, i.e. source consciousness, is continually grooming facilitators to be of best service, because we are essentially vessels and bridges to then switch on other people as this species activation and remembrance that we have this divine essence within us is occurring. And so we have a sacred responsibility, in my feeling and in perspective, to be the best uses, the best vessels to serve source consciousness. That is who we serve. And when our egos get out of the way and when we purify ourselves and our shadow, then source can work through us to serve the community, okay? And if you don't have that perspective, and I don't want to project this, I'm saying this is my perspective. I believe it's integral, but I believe if we're just looking at it from a baseline perspective, like here's a drug, here's a medicine, we're going to serve people, we're going to serve 70 people in a day, boom, 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 30 grand over there. There are some facilitators that serve large amounts of people. I mean, you know, it just starts to become power. It starts to become aggrandizement of power, which maybe it's clean, but it's just going to create a fractal ripple of repercussions. So I'm not saying you have to be an ascetic and you have to be poverty consciousness. I'm saying keep your field clean and be aware of your shit and how that may be affecting the way you serve.
Yeah. And, you know, another idea that we could even interject here, that going back to your statement of, well, sort of the honeymoon period was over. And there is this problem of people creating a whole identity around I'm someone who facilitates, or I'm a shaman, or this is my church, or this is my temple. And it can become a job and it becomes an identity. But then there's also the possibility that someone can facilitate and then also decide, you know what, I think I'm done facilitating. Like for myself, that was my own approach, that when I was facilitating for a number of years, I felt like, okay, I'm really learning some things here, and I'm seeing new results. I'm seeing different reactions. I'm seeing different things and learning. And then it did reach a point where I felt like, okay, you know, I think I've seen most of what I'm going to see. And it didn't feel like I was learning anymore. And that was one of the factors that led me to say, okay, well, think I'm done facilitating. And now I just want to share what I've learned from facilitating, but I have no interest in being a lifetime facilitator. And
exactly.
And that's a possibility for people as well, that they can facilitate for a time then step back and share.
So look upon this fact that there is a life cycle to a facilitator. There's the honeymoon phase, there's a rush of enthusiasm. And on a practical level, what I've seen happen is communities form, relationships form, support teams form. You know, a lot of facilitators do the retreat model, and then after a while, it either burns out or you come back to single thing. But there is there's a bell curve and a progression to the life cycle of a facilitator, and there is burnout. And exactly as you said, there is this idea of completion. It's like, all right, I've mastered and completed this level of, like, what do you want to teach me? Continue. Like, I really feel the real reason I serve is to keep a hand into the medicine, to continue my connection to the medicine and my path with the medicine. But I've also, you know, always said, I'm also a media maker, you know, documentaries and films and discussions and lectures. And there's a whole consolidation of the teachings I have learned and whatever wisdom I have accrued. I don't necessarily serve full time, and it gets to this point, if I haven't served for a while, I'm like, do I really want to do this anymore? And then when I experience the medicine again, I realize that feeling and that connection and that relationship with source consciousness is the highest and most integral relationship I can have in my life. And so if being of service as a midwife facilitator is part of that, then I will continue to do that. But I'm pacing myself now. I realize it's a long distance run, not a sprint. And that, you know, as I said before, a lot of my service goes into facilitating the community's awareness of 5-MeO, like this discussion or this book or conferences and lectures and talks. And again, there are many ways to serve, right? And so, you know, I'm hoping to do some retreats with Joel Briere in Mexico this summer, 2022. And we're developing a program called Bridging Heaven, which is basically, you could say, microdosing 5-MeO DMT in tandem with Vedic practices like pranayama, breath work, meditation, things like that, to enable people to anchor the pathways and the feeling to then go away from the retreat and away from the external medicine and to keep the gate open. I have worked with so many yogis and meditators that once they've had a full experience on the external catalyst and then come back to their internal practice, they can dip in and out of samadhi consciousness ongoingly, the bridge, right? And this is where I believe is the ultimate goal of us as a community, and that we lose track of this amongst the egos, amongst the first blush of enthusiasm, amongst the commodification of the sacred in therapy and the psychedelic renaissance, is that there is a goal here. And so I feel in some levels on my journey as a facilitator, I'm probably 2/3 of the way through. Okay, I've got all the groundwork under point. But, you know, I say to everyone I work with, you can meditate, you can do breath work, you can do these modalities to keep the gate open. And I haven't been doing my homework. And it is time that I do my homework. And I can show through example, right? And I know so many yogi friends that have done 5 that do this. They can go in and out of this state without the external medicine, because 5-MeO is in us. We are the medicine. And so for me, this Bridging Heaven idea is the next step. And we're doing that as a prototype to bring that to the community and to bring that model to the community. And really, I envisage it like a Vipassana thing eventually, that it can be franchised out, that if the model works, I want to share that with people so everyone can experience these pathway to their own divine innate connection.
Beautiful. Let's talk about public education for a moment. And you and I, we also have some similarities here in that I previously organized the Exploring Psychedelics conference here in Ashland and put a heavy emphasis on 5-MeO-DMT for that conference to bring people in to educate people. It's also been a major feature of my podcast and a major topic of my own writing and interviews and all the rest of that. And you were integral in helping to form WBAC, the World Bufal Various Congress, which was not necessarily kind of like this book here. This book is not intended as a training manual for anyone. This is not how to facilitate. This is how different people facilitate and what their concerns are. And so much similar at the World Bufal Various Congress, that was not a training module, but that was more of community discussion, community sharing, connection. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, especially because it's mentioned by many people who are contributing to this book that they either attended there or they spoke there. That was their first exposure. So tell us a little bit about the philosophy and the idea behind WBAC.
As I said before, I'll dig it out. I've got it somewhere, this one pager, and it's like, 100 notes in a sort of mind map there. And it wasn't called WBAC, but this idea to create a container, almost a ceremony. And that's what we treated WBAC as a ceremony of us, of the 5-MeO community. And the idea was there. It's like, because intuitively, and that's my greatest gift, is this intuitive pattern matching, ability to connect and get these downloads. It's like, I could see that this was culminating in the growth in the community that needed an above ground container to hold space for people to come together. And so I started initiating that in 2017 at, I think at your conference, when Mario Garnier came, I think he did speak. Hari, his partner Hari, who is a mighty curandera in her own right. I seated it there, and I caught up with him in Mexico amongst my doing facilitation work over there. And we brought it together on a shoestring, on a wing and a prayer, because it was all done with community. It was done, he's a media maker as well. He pulled together all the people he knew. And, we held space for the community to come together. Dr. Michael Villanueva, who's the neuroscientist who was doing 5-MeO research with Terra Incognita, my now defunct organization, he said at Juan Acosta's talk back in 2015, I think at the AWARE Project, this idea that there's entrainment which happens, and there's a hypercoherence which happens in the synaptic pathways of the brain on 5-MeO-DMT, as well as all the default mode network stuff, there's this hypercoherence. Micro and macro scale and mirror each other. So if you look at the culture, people are individually little neurons in the larger cultural, brain, let's say, and people are having these 5-MeO experiences, but it's creating these sort of synaptic pathways of connection where this hypercoherence happens culturally. When I first did 5-MeO in 2015, I would step out, I got to LA, and I would step out of a taxi and someone would be talking about 5-MeO-DMT at the bus stop, or I would bump into someone randomly. But it felt, the statistical odds of these connections were not probable, right? And I started to intuitively feel that when we've been activated and we've got this thing, there's some type of residual hypercoherence in the cultural structure. And so something like WBAC was bringing that all together into one container where it could be manifest and it could be felt and it could have, the butterfly effect of its ramifications of our growth and entrainment, where we did try to hold space for giving a lot of information about best practices and toad handling and conservation and ethics and, all the different cultural things which constituently add up to a community, right? And that's what it was all about.
Yeah. So, speaking of toads, that's another main question that a lot of people are addressing in this book here is the question of sustainable harvesting of toad secretions versus the use of synthetic. And there is sometimes the supposition that toad is better because it's natural, so therefore it must be better and superior. And I was just wondering if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share about the toads themselves, sustainable harvesting, and that the natural versus synthetic distinction that some people hold to very strongly and other people don't.
All paths lead to God, ultimately, in the end. So I did a lot of work with toad conservation. I poured a lot of my life into giving back and making sure there were ethical and sustainable pathways to toad cultivation. Fair trade toad was something I tried to get off the ground, working with the Mexican community and the indigenous communities of Sonora. has proved difficult in this bottomless pit of trying to support essentially people in second world conditions in Sonora to be caretakers of the medicine and to try to kickstart a Fair Toad program. But there are existing documents that we've worked with herpetologists which have outlined very clearly, and they were up on Fair Trade Toad, they were up on WeBack, they might have disappeared on the net, but I'm happy to provide them, which document best handling practices for toads and how to minimize stress and impact, how to under-harvest, not over-harvest, how to ethically, you know, harvest the medicine. Essentially, I prefer toad, not from any hippie new age perspective that organic is better. You can get, I just think we need all the pathways we can get. Obviously, and you know, Hamilton Morris has done a lot of good work in promoting the synthetic and revealing Albert Most and the whole thing. But here's the thing, no one in the world has done, well, Terra Incognita did a toad conservation study in Tucson in 2017, but it was, you know, it was like a dozen sites across the area. Looking for chytrid and things, the fungus, which may affect their health and well-being. But when people say toads are endangered mainly through climate change, through insect die-off, and the toads which aggregate around the pueblos around Sonora and with collectors around there are essentially marginal. One toad can birth thousands of eggs, and it's climate change which will affect toads more than human handling. The human handling, which we can see, and we can see documented in the issues around the cartels and the toad farms and the collectors. You know, I tried to instigate a union of collectors to agree to ethical principles for fair toad collection. I walked out barely with my life. I mean, We met in Sonora. I was told not to come back under danger of physical threat because there are power dynamics involved on the cartel, drug running, cultural level, yada yada yada, and it's beyond any one person to solve. The best thing, and we did this at WeBack. We launched some hashtags, Know Your Source, with a number 5 for the S in source, and things like that to try to get the grassroots to inform the community to ask their practitioners and facilitators, are you ethically sourcing the medicine? So, you know, it really comes down to that. It comes down to facilitators asking whoever they're getting their medicine from in Mexico and Sonora, do they ascribe to fair trade toad principles and to ethical harvesting of the medicine? And that's sort of the best we can do at this point. It's supply and demand in the marketplace to hold people to the best conditions for that. In terms of synthetic, I think there's a great place for it. I have nothing against it. I've experienced it many times. And there's just personally something in the entourage effect of the 17 to 20 other alkaloids in toad that I feel more. And because I've now had a relationship with that, it's about my relationship with toad. I have nothing against synthetic. I would also point out that I really believe it's time for the community to start really heavily investigating in plant-based sources for 5-MeO-DMT. And I would point to Phalaris grass, the Tyrannosaurus rex of plant-based 5-MeO-DMT, which has an incredibly easy extraction process according to the online guides. It's just that you need a truckload of Phalaris, but it's a grass which grows quickly, easily, freely. You just need a lot of it to come down. And, you know, there's Yopo seeds and there's Chalaponga and other things. We don't want to, I mean, whatever we do, and this is a larger discussion around the sustainability of entheogens that are secreted by nature, as the psychedelic renaissance is promoted by Western media and by the big money, which is invested in psychedelics now, as it's become a capitalist commodity, as it scales up to embrace the tens of millions of new people coming into psychedelics, the entheogens are depleted and are endangered around the world. Iboga is now endangered. Ayahuasca has issues with replanting the toad. It's not just any one entheogen. It's about capitalism, consumerism, and the need to be healed. And again, this is what I point to. All of the entheogens are training wheels. We can do this ourselves, but we need to learn how to remember. And I think I'd like to leave it there.
All right. And just to mention one thing that I read earlier today that I thought was quite fascinating, that apparently a scientist has developed the growing of toad glands in the lab without toads that then can biologically produce 5-MeO-DMT and is looking to make this available to research institutions and laboratories.
I see Facebook posts, commenting on that possibility. And I was like, why would you bother trying to create, lab-grown bufotenine, 5-MeO, 7-MeO? I'm like, okay, if you can, great. I mean, but this is what I mean. Every pathway is needed, and every pathway that is safe can also be sacred. And it's not as if any one path is better or worse. It's about sustainability and sacred reciprocity.
Excellent. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to hit on that you had on your own personal list, but I think it's been a great conversation, Rack, and lots of juicy material here. So awesome.
Thank you so much, Martin, for all that you do in this community, and much love to you.
Thank you, Rack.